All right, well, thank you, Tam and Susan, both for inviting me to give this presentation to be part of the CETA-sponsored symposium this morning. I am going to talk on the subject of the historical importance of entomology to social and environmental issues. Insects have certainly changed the course of history many times. They've been responsible for the outcome of wars, both positive and negative, depending on which side you're on, I guess. And they've certainly caused famines, promoted language shifts, influenced human settlement patterns, promoted new industries, impacted human health in very many ways. And I'm planning to show how some of these impacts have occurred using historical examples from the entomological background. I'm going to use an approach of looking at different insect species as examples, and these will include silkworm, the oriental rat flea, human body louse, mosquitoes, specifically the yellow fever mosquito, and finally the boll weevil. We begin with discussion of the silkworm and its impact on human society, and we're all familiar with the Silk Road, this trade route that was developed, a series of routes between the Orient and China and the Middle East, had its origins centuries and millennia, actually, before the time of Christ. And at the period of 500 years after the death of Christ, the Silk Road looked more or less as you see in this map here, linking Southeast Asia, India, Indonesia, and China with the Middle East. Silk, of course, was a major trade item. There was a real thirst for silk in the Roman Empire, in the Middle East, and throughout the Mediterranean Basin. But silk was responsible, in a sense, for a lot of trade over this route that included spices, porcelain, and many other items coming east, and other items going coming west, and other items going to the east. But also, it was important because ideas, cultures, religious ideas passed back and forth throughout this period of the Silk Road. Silk, of course, was such an important commodity that it was, once the secrets of how silk was actually produced became known, legend has it that a couple of monks brought stages of the silkworm to the Middle East, carried in a cane and given to the Emperor Justinian in the year 552 AD. At that point in time, silk began to be produced in Constantinople, and this, of course, had important impacts because it eliminated to a great extent the cost, the risks, and the dangers of carrying silk products and other items over the Silk Road. From that time, throughout the Middle Ages, silk production began to move throughout the Mediterranean regions, and a lot of silk was produced, particularly in the countries of Italy and France. Some of the finest silk in the world was said to be produced in this small red province of France, the province of Como. But it was also important in the rise of the economy of Florence and other cities in Italy as well. From an economic standpoint and from a social standpoint, this production of silk throughout the Mediterranean region was extremely important to bring some level of economic well-being to the poor of these areas. That was very common for poor people in rural areas to set up looms and weave silk cloths, adding to the quality of life for many poor people. This became such an important part of the economies of these countries that, as a side note, when the silk industry, the cottage industries in France, around 1860 were threatened because of a die-off in silkworms. The government of France decided that it was such a serious issue that they hired Louis Pasteur to come in and look at the problem. Pasteur moved into the silk-producing areas of France, spent 3 years studying the problem, finally determined that that a protozoan infection was killing these silkworm larvae, developed a method of control, and basically can be credited with saving the rural economy of France and the social structure of the country in about 1865 to 70. He published that information. Probably the more important aspect, in addition to the economy and the well-being of this rural population, was the fact that he did link a microorganism with disease of an organism, in this case the silkworm. So in a very real way, this led to the development of the germ theory of disease, and silkworms, of course, and entomology and insects played a big role in this advancing of the science of medicine at that time. I'll talk a little bit about the rat flea, the Oriental rat flea, and of course we're all familiar with the fact that there were several major pandemics of bubonic plague in Europe over the ages. The first of these was called the Justinian Plague. It occurred in the mid-6th century. Of course, it was brought in from Africa, it's believed, on wheat shipments that were destined for Constantinople to feed the people ruled still by Justinian. It's kind of interesting that this occurred just 10 years before that silkworm was brought into to Constantinople. But this plague, once it reached the Mediterranean, spread very rapidly. It is estimated that as many as 25 million people died from the disease in the area that's shown in red in the map here, which represented the Byzantine Empire at that point in time. And it spread even further into the Iberian Peninsula, France, and up into England. Over the next several centuries, the plague recurred in pockets throughout this region, and it's estimated that as many as perhaps 100 million people died from the plague over the several hundred years following this initial huge pandemic. The impacts on society of this were tremendous, and I mentioned just a few. It's suggested that the Roman Empire, as it existed at that time, 550 years AD, was irreparably weakened. There was such a loss of life due to this that agricultural interests could not be maintained. The Roman Empire could not feed itself as well as it needed to. The countries that supported the Roman Empire became subject to invasion at later dates, and essentially the Roman Empire over the next century or so pretty much ceased to exist as a powerful political entity. And certainly this was kind of the beginning of the Dark Ages as well. The people that were experiencing this huge loss of life lost their faith in learning and knowledge, the medical arts as they existed at that time, and basically we entered a period of lawlessness, ignorance, and superstition that was to last for quite a few centuries through the Dark Ages. And also at this time, not believing in the sciences, the populations turned to belief in religion, and the Christian religion particularly was to become very strong as a force in society for the next 800 years or so. In the 14th century, almost 800 years to the year, following the initial Justinian plague, we had the mass pandemic of plague again, which essentially within a 4-year period, very similar to what happened 800 years earlier, wiped through European population, as you can see in the map here. And again, some 25, perhaps as many as 50 million people were killed during this pandemic. Again, this persisted in pockets throughout Europe and actually spread into Central Asia and into the Indian subcontinent. And it's estimated again that perhaps 75 million people were killed over the succeeding generations from this particular pandemic, which still had impacts on the human population well into the 18th century. And this created some very serious social impacts as well. Obviously, food production was immediately interrupted because of the loss of laborers to the disease through death. This time, instead of bolstering religion, religion had reached such a powerful state in Europe, particularly the Catholic Church, the people felt the church and their belief in God should have protected them from this plague, and they began to lose faith in the church, and it began to lose political power because of the plague. And finally, or thirdly, the demise of the feudal system occurred. There was so much loss of labor, so much loss of skilled artisans, that suddenly those who did survive were in great demand. And instead of being subject to individual landowners and landlords, they could begin to command more return for their skills, even if that was simply agricultural labor. So, again, the demise of the feudal system began as a result of this huge loss of lives. I'll mention briefly the human body louse as a vector of infectious typhus. Of course, this is caused by the the rickettsia disease, just say it's a rickettsial disease. Too early in the morning to that. But typhus has always been a disease pretty much of squalor. It occurs when groups of people are put into close confinement and living with poor sanitation, inability to do their normal ability to clean themselves and change clothes and so forth. These types of conditions have typically been associated with war, with troops, even up to World War II. This was a problem, and it's only been the advent of pesticides that have been allowed us to free our troops of typhus to a great extent, as was the case in World War II. But I would like to mention a particular instance history gives us of how the body louse, the human body louse, impacted humanity even to this day in a very large way. You're familiar with the Napoleonic Wars in the early part of the 19th century. Napoleon, I'll particularly mention the war, the advancement on Russia. Napoleon had 495,000 troops, the so-called Grand Army, that he massed to march eastward toward Moscow to try to overcome Russia, which would allow him, if he was successful, to move westward and hopefully overtake England, and then ultimately perhaps get more of a foothold in the New World. He already had conquered and had subjected most of Western Europe to his dominion. But this troop began moving eastward because of the conditions of poor food supplies to the troops and the weather, and coming in contact with some very squalid conditions in Western Russia. His troops became infected with the typhus and contact with the body lice, and very quickly began to lose the power of that army. This was compounded, of course, when he reached Moscow, and the Russians had very cleverly moved out of the city, left no food behind. This huge, terrible winter set in. The combination of typhus, weather, began reducing his troops to the point that he realized that if he didn't get out of Russia and get back into Western Europe, he would essentially see total annihilation. So by the time his troops got back to Europe, where they could be fed properly, his army of nearly 5 $100,000 was reduced to $40,000 troops, and essentially the Grand Army had been broken. Napoleon was not able to continue his goal of dominating the world, and as a result, we're speaking English here instead of French, I think so. Mention briefly the mosquito as a yellow fever mosquito as a vector of disease. Again, an interesting example comes from the Napoleonic Wars. Napoleon had desires to set up a beachhead in Haiti in 1802. He sent 20,000 troops under the command of a brother-in-law to Haiti, which had been becoming under the control of a slave uprising, slaves that had been brought from Africa to help in the production of sugarcane under French colonialists there. Because these slaves had brought with them yellow fever and malaria, they were pretty well immune or somewhat immune to these diseases. But these troops that came over to quell this uprising had no exposure previous to yellow fever. And after they arrived, within a week, they made pretty good inroads into fighting against the natives. But very quickly, yellow fever set in, and within a few months, these troops were forced to evacuate and return to France, with only about 3,000 of the original 20,000 troops remaining to return to France, most of whom died from yellow fever, only 1,000 or so from actual combat wounds. What this meant was that Napoleon's plans to establish a beachhead in Haiti and that would allow him to move into the United States, what is now the United States, but North America, up the Mississippi River valleys to strengthen the French claims over what is now the Louisiana Territory, what was in the Louisiana Territory, failed. Instead, he went back to France, or in France, he decided to sell the Louisiana Territory to the United States, to Thomas Jefferson, for a sum of about $15 million. And we essentially doubled the size of the United States with one transaction there. And this allowed for the American public to expand westward, which was to have significant consequences for the development of the United States as a result, really, of the yellow fever mosquito. And of course, we're all familiar with the fact that the French tried to fulfill a contract to build the Panama Canal around the turn of the 19th, 20th century. After losses over a number of years of upwards of 20,000 laborers and engineers, they finally gave up. The United States took up the contract to build the canal. And fortunately, about that time, Walter Reed and others had determined that the cause of this yellow fever disease was linked to the yellow fever mosquito. They were able to develop methods of preventing the disease to a great extent, and we were able to finish the construction of the Panama Canal, and this has had a tremendous impact on the economy of the United States and our ability to control the shipping for the next 100 years through the world shipping trade through the Panama Canal. Finally, I'd like to talk about the boll weevil and its impact on society and the environment in southeastern United States. This was certainly the story of an invasive insect. Recall that cotton was king in southeastern United States from the time, essentially, of the invention of the cotton gin up well into the 20th century. Cotton was grown as a monoculture. It was such an important cash crop in the southern U.S. that farmers basically abandoned any other crops. They planted only cotton. It provided enough income that they could buy everything else that they needed with the profits from cotton. So they didn't produce their own food. They bought it from the north. They bought clothes from the north. Essentially, cotton was provided everything for the southern farmer. It did require high labor inputs, and this was provided initially through the slave labor from slaves brought in from Africa or from the Caribbean after they were no longer being used in sugarcane production. And even after the abolition of slavery in 1865, the black African American labor continued to be critical to the production of cotton, both as hired hands and as sharecroppers. So in 1892, the boll weevil jumped across the Rio Grande River down in the South Texas region near Brownsville, West Laco, as we know it today, and began to spread rapidly through the cotton belt, 40 miles or more per year. And within 30 years, it had basically covered the entire range, reaching North Carolina and Virginia by 1922. Just typical of what happened in other areas, although it was delayed in North Carolina, for example, but I have data for North Carolina. Once the cotton gin was developed, cotton began to be produced in increasingly greater numbers, and acreage in North Carolina increased dramatically up until 1892, when the boll weevil entered Texas, but of course wasn't in North Carolina. The production continued to increase in North Carolina up to 1.8 million acres. By the mid-1920s, when the boll weevil had pretty much covered the state, and then it dropped precipitously and continuously up until the mid-1980s, when the boll weevil eradication program came into being. And of course, since that time, production in North Carolina has jumped up to as high as a million acres, again, taking a prominent place in agriculture in the South. And a similar pattern occurred at earlier dates in other states. In its wake, the boll weevil caused losses of crops of 50%, even up to 80-90% in individual fields. This meant that the growers could not sustain production. Bankers would no longer loan money to the cotton growers, because they knew they would not get sufficient returns on the investment. And basically, this caused economic disaster for the southern cotton farmer. And even worse for the sharecroppers who depended on the farmers for their loans and income so that they could plant crops on the farmer's land. There have been a number of impacts, some of these on social issues. One was the partial cause of the migration of African American population from the South to the North. Coupled with the loss of jobs, the opportunities to make a living, came World War I. During World War I, essentially, immigration from Europe was stopped, so that that supply of the labor market was no longer available to the Northern industries. At the same time, many of the workers in the North joined the war effort and went to Europe. This created a big vacuum in the labor market. Because of the boll weevil, there were a lot of black African-American people in the South that moved quickly to the North. The North realized that this was a market of labor that they could tap. There was this mass migration. The African-American population did very well in these jobs, and they've established themselves and continue to fill those roles to the present day. A second impact was the development of strengthening of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They sent entomologists quickly into the southern regions following the introduction of the boll weevil. These entomologists were able to come up with a few tools, particularly the use of calcium arsenate, as well as timing of plantings to avoid the damage by the boll weevil, and a few other methods. They used a series of county talks, bringing growers in and giving their information to them so that they could take this back to the farms. Certainly the production of cotton was never back to the level that it was with the presence of the boll weevil, but at least growers were able to make a profit and grow cotton again. This model of county activities led to influenced the Cooperative Extension Service, which was established under the Smith-Lever Act in 1914, which provided for a county office in every county in the United States because of the success of the boll weevil program. Another impact was the birth of the aerial application. Calcium arsenate was the product that was used to kill boll weevils. After World War II, there were many pilots who were very adept at flying planes very, very skillfully. Entrepreneurs realized that the ground application methods that had been used were too slow and laborious and dangerous to treat all the acreage of cotton that was needed. They outfitted biplanes, or the planes of the day, with mechanism to allow the distribution of calcium arsenate as a dust. One of the groups that came in, a company that was producing a particular line of airplanes up in New Jersey, moved into the Delta, saw the opportunities here for a business, became what was then known as the Delta Air Corporation. This particular group went on to begin carrying mail and ultimately a few passengers, and over a number of iterations, they morphed into what is now, we know now as Delta Airlines. Again, all because of the boll weevil. And another impact, of course, was the diversification of our cropping systems. We're all familiar, I think, with the boll weevil monument in Enterprise, Alabama, which was erected in 1919 in appreciation of the boll weevil coming in and forcing people to realize that they could no longer rely on cotton as a single source of income. Peanuts were introduced into the this Coffee County, Alabama area. Became immediately obvious that this was going to be a great cash crop, and resulted in the realization that throughout the cotton growing areas, it was going to be necessary to diversify if farmers were going to succeed. This led to the eradication program that we're now involved in at this point in time. Cotton was able to be produced with boll weevils, but it took a large number of pesticide applications. It took on the average of anywhere from 10 to 15 or more applications of synthetic hydrocarbon, organochlorine type and organophosphate type pesticides to produce a cotton crop successfully and defeat the boll weevil. This was probably realized as not being a sustainable situation. And some 45 years ago, groups decided, including federal government, state government, grower organizations, got together and said, maybe it's possible to eradicate the boll weevil. They developed the tools that were available at the time through research, and finally in the mid-80s established a program in North Carolina to eradicate the weevil. Over 7 to 10 years, this proved to be extremely successful. Cotton acreage in the absence of boll weevil in North Carolina, as I said earlier, jumped up to nearly half of its original 1.8 million acres, and the program was then moved across the United States. In the map that you see here, the blue and green regions, dark green regions, are the cotton growing regions of southern United States. The boll weevil has been eradicated from all of the blue states, and this was last year's data, and it's well on its way to eradication in the dark green states, including northern Mexico in the state of Chihuahua and south of the Rio Grande. And it's estimated that by 2011-2012, there will not be a single boll weevil left in the United States. And this is having a tremendous impact on the lives of southern farmers, because cotton can become a lucrative crop again as part of a very diverse agricultural system. Not to the extent that it was before the boll weevil, but certainly a major part of the economy of southern United States. So I've just given you a few historically obvious examples of how insects have impacted mankind and human society, the environment. Clearly, insects have changed history, human behavior, societal values, and quality of life on these macro scales many times throughout history. Could have brought in many more, but that's the subject of an entire course, I think, in entomology. So again, I appreciate your attention. I appreciate the opportunity to talk today, and I'll end with that.
We'll take time for a question or two.
Bruce.
Jim, do you really think there won't be a single boll weevil in the entire U.S. in 2012 or whatever year?
Well, history shows us that there will be the potential for movement of boll weevils back in by human activities. In North Carolina, we've been weevil free, except for a few years where we believe that laborers coming up from Mexico have brought in weevils on their automobiles, and they've been trapped. But we do maintain a trapping system throughout the region that hopefully will detect weevils before they have a chance to become reestablished, and draconian measures are taken to eliminate any of those types of reinfestations. So I would repeat the question, which was, do we really believe that the boll weevil will not ever come back or occur in the United States?
So. Thank you, Jim.
Okay.